With the election of Donald Trump, the term nationalism burst again into American political discourse. Trump's slogan for his campaign, Make America Great Again, was followed after his election by another, Put America First. For a lot, especially people on the left, this had kind of chilling overtones of Charles Lindbergh's support of fascism in the 1930s. For others, it meant the racism of white nationalists as expressed in the deadly confrontation in Charlottesville, Virginia last year. Nationalism is also a word that is often associated with the drive to Great Britain's vote to exit the European Union. Like many political terms thrown about in the media, nationalism is often ill-defined and either used as a slogan or an insult. Our guest this hour has undertaken a deep historical and philosophical study of the meaning of nationalism, and he's concluded that far from being an evil, nationalism has the potential to address many of the ills of the modern world, which he blames actually on imperialism and the desire of modern liberalism to impose a universal standard of morals on the world. It's a very controversial and provocative message, and we'll examine it today. Our guest is Yoram Hazony. His new book is called The Virtue of Nationalism. Dr. Hazony is president of the Herzl Institute in Jerusalem. He's also the director of the John Templeton Foundation's Project in Jewish Philosophical Theology and has authored several other books about Israel and Jewish theology. He joins us today from Jerusalem. Good morning, Dr. Hazony.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
I guess I should say good evening to you in this case.
Here it's dark.
Yes. Let's start with your book. One could easily guess that as an Israeli, you would be drawn to the concept of nationalism because Israel has such a strong, cohesive national identity. Was this clear to you from an early age?
It's something that I inherited, as I read at the beginning of the book. It's something I actually inherited from my parents and grandparents. Israel is like many other countries, has a tradition of looking at nationalism as the movement, the force, the ideal that liberated the country from foreign powers, and that's definitely the way that I grew up with the word. On the other hand, the centrality of the nation in Anglo-American political thought is something that I've studied professionally, you know, as a political theorist, and comparing the two is interesting and useful.
So, a former justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Potter Stewart, is famously quoted as saying, "I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it." And I imagine that's a similar case for many Americans when they encounter the term nationalism. So, what exactly is your definition of nationalism?
Nationalism is a principled standpoint that sees the world as being governed best when nations are allowed to chart an independent course. So if you believe that the national independence of the United States, of Britain, India, Israel, Poland, Italy, Ethiopia, if you believe in a world that is constructed in that way, with independent countries making decisions for themselves according to their own national constitutional traditions, then you're a nationalist. And that's as opposed to an imperialist, which is a view that would say, peace and prosperity are never going to come to the world until we overcome borders and we overcome the divisions among nations. And we have some kind of central rulemaking authority that can impose justice on the world when necessary.
And so when you talk about those central authorities that exist currently in the world, you're really talking about organizations like the United Nations or the European Union.
Definitely the European Union qualifies as what I'm calling an empire, since its goal is to remove sovereign decision-making authority from the member nations. At this point, it's dozens of nations that have much of their law given to them by foreign bureaucracies and judged by foreign courts. I'm sure people in in a country like Greece or Italy or Hungary or Poland these days are feeling that the EU is in fact an empire, at least a budding empire. I think that in the book, I also want to draw the attention of Americans to something that they don't naturally instinctively think of as imperialism, but I'd like for you and your listeners at least to consider it. Beginning after the fall of the Berlin Wall, a series of American presidents, beginning with George H.W. Bush, adopted a view that Bush called the New World Order. And, Bush is not normally considered to be, some kind of starry-eyed utopian. And still in his speeches about New World Order, what he described for us was after thousands of generations, he said, humanity is finally going to be able to replace the law of the jungle with the rule of law throughout the world. And his concept was that the United Nations, as you say, the Security Council, would be kind of like a final decision maker, making rules for the world. And the American armed forces, together with allied contingents, would then be responsible for imposing it. So by my proposal, you'd have to see that also as being some kind of an imperialist vision, because what it says is better not to let other nations make decisions for themselves. We need the United Nations or the United States to make the decisions and then to impose them when necessary.
I want to follow up on that a little bit more. We're speaking with Dr. Yoram Hazony, who is the author of a new book called The Virtue of Nationalism. We'll have more on that subject here on the Jefferson Exchange in just 60 seconds after a break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio, I'm John Baxter. You can join the conversation this morning by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. We're talking about nationalism and the virtues of nationalism. That's the title of a new book written by Yoram Hazony. He is our guest this morning on the phone from his home in Jerusalem. And just before the break, you were talking about the concept that George Herbert Walker Bush, the first President Bush, put forward of the New World Order. And I want to take a moment because of, kind of some of the quirks of American political discourse, because I'd like to address fairly early in this hour the term that you use in the book of liberalism, because the way that you use that term and liberal universalism don't really conform to the typical American political shorthand of liberal versus conservative. Because, for example, Americans would see the administrations of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama as liberal, and then George Herbert Walker Bush, who you've mentioned before our break, and then George W. Bush's son as conservative. But all of those administrations engaged in action on the world stage that would fall under your definition of liberal imperialism.
Yeah, I think there may be some differences in culture between the West Coast and what people say in Washington. Also, the term liberal internationalism is in sort of the think among the think tanks and academics and diplomats who spend their time professionally talking about these things. Liberal internationalism is the name for this, is the most commonly used name for this idea of world order in which Americans and Europeans, I mean, with mostly American might, but Americans and Europeans together would make the rules for the rest of the world. And so you'll see people like Henry Kissinger or Robert Kagan, when they talk in favor or against this kind of a world order, It's very often the shorthand is that it's called liberal internationalism, and the critics of it, and my book definitely qualifies as a critic, they want to draw attention to some of the downsides of having a world in which if you are, you know, the Serbs or the Libyans or the Iraqis or the Afghanis or the Egyptians, and you are misbehaving according to the standards of the Americans or the Europeans, and here I'm not questioning, you know, that you know maybe these governments commit atrocities or behave badly, but the policy during most of the last generation up until, I mean, basically between the end of the Cold War and up until President Trump, American foreign policy has assumed that if a government steps out of line, Madeleine Albright once said, if they don't play by the rules, then that's a reason to begin military operations. In the case of Serbia, bombing Serbia up until the government collapses. In the case of Iraq, an actual invasion complete with occupation and writing a new constitution for Iraq. That kind of a policy in which America and its allies are the police force for the entire world, that's what's meant by liberal internationalism. I give it a little bit of a tweak in my book. I call it liberal imperialism because I think that it does have some significantly nastier sides to it than some of its supporters are usually willing to admit.
And also in your book, you talk about our interpretation of what Nazi Germany was. You see Nazi Germany, many people would say, well, that's an example of nationalism run amok, you know, to its most evil end. But you say that Nazi Germany actually was not nationalist, it was imperialist.
Of course, Hitler called himself a national socialist, but I don't recommend that socialists learn their socialism from Hitler, and I don't recommend that nationalists learn their nationalism from Hitler. I'd like to try to stay to terms as they're commonly used, and the most common traditional usage of the term nationalism is what I suggested, that a nationalist is someone who, if you're an Indian nationalist, you want independence from India. It doesn't mean that you want to take over the world and have it run by Indians. If you're a French nationalist, it means you want independence for France. It doesn't mean you want to take over the entire planet. And Hitler in Mein Kampf, not that I recommend that people spend their time reading this kind of thing, but you can take my word for it, or you can look it up. Hitler in Mein Kampf calls for Germany to be the mistress of the globe or the lord of the earth. And that was the plan from the beginning. So if you ask, why does Hitler invade France and then Britain and then the Soviet Union? It's not in order to unify the German people and give them independence. It's in order to be mistress of the globe. So that's imperialism by anybody's definition. And it's just a strange quirk of the way we talk today, that even though Hitler's clearly, by anybody's definition, an imperialist, we like to say he's a nationalist, and then use that in order to delegitimize anybody else who wants to be a nationalist.
So your concept of nationalism, as it's laid out in your book, is rooted in the Old Testament. How is that? How so?
Well, this is it's an important idea, I think. I look at it in two respects. First of all, just trying to understand what the political theory of the Hebrew Bible is. That in itself is an important and interesting exercise. But then there's also the question of how does the idea of national independence come to be such an important idea in Europe? Medieval Europe didn't have an idea of national independence. Medieval Europe had a concept of the Holy Roman Empire and of universal monarchy. And the Protestants really put this idea of independent nationhood on the table. Henry VIII in 1534 declares the independence of England from the Holy Roman Empire and from the papacy, from the Pope. And he's followed in 1581 by the Dutch and the Swiss in 1648 and the Americans in 1776. So one of the things that I thought was important to do in this book is to try to understand where does this unprecedented idea of national independence come from. And my argument is that that if you search the ancient world, all the texts that we have from the ancient Middle East and then later from Greece and Rome, the only sustained argument that you find in favor of this idea of that independent nations with living within borders that they're not allowed to cross, living side by side with other independent nations, that kind of world is a better world than a world run by one empire. The only place you find it is in Hebrew scripture, in the Old Testament. And of course, those of your listeners who read Bible are familiar with the fact that throughout the Old Testament and then going on into the New Testament, it's a world of empires. The Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Persians, the Romans, Alexander the Great. Everybody's got this this idea that we can actually read in archaeological, in the tablets that are dug up in throughout the Middle East. This idea that the gods send the great king, the ruler of Assyria or Babylonia, they send him to bring peace and prosperity to the earth by conquering the four corners of the earth. Their political theory is based on the idea that one law needs to be imposed on all mankind, and that this will end war, this will bring peace, this will bring prosperity. And so once you notice this, it's kind of astonishing to think that with all these empires competing to bring peace to the world, the Hebrew prophets, all of them, stand up and take an opposing point of view and paint this universal empire, this dream, as being inherently unjust. And of course, the prophetic vision is for the nations of the world, each of them to be under God, but each of them to maintain its own independence and its own freedom. And that, in fact, is I argue in the book that in fact is the not just the principal source, but really almost the only source of the early modern Christian enthusiasm for declaring independence of nations and recognizing the independence of nations is in Scripture.
So you also lay out in your book a sort of, I guess I could call it a hierarchy, where you go through family, tribe, clan, and then nation. Can you explain that a bit for us?
Well, part of what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to challenge the common way in which most of us are taught about politics, and certainly in university, but a lot of us in high school, where politics is sort of thought of as being beginning with individuals who live by themselves, and then they enter into an agreement, into a social contract, and set up a state. There's a number of important Enlightenment philosophers who saw politics that way, and it's kind of been handed down to us as if it were true. And I don't actually think it's true. I'm certainly not anywhere near the first person to make this challenge, but a lot of important thinkers tried to challenge this without succeeding in dislodging it. And so what I try to do is I try to give the readers a view of the of what politics works like that that is closer to the truth, and that then makes more sense of the idea of the independence of nations. So the basic argument is that human beings are never anywhere really completely individuals. Human beings are sticky. They form into groups everywhere in every society that you go to. You know, from children to adults, everywhere in the world and at every point in history, put human beings together and they form into these groups. What holds them together is what I call mutual loyalty. This is something John Stuart Mill wrote a whole lot about. He called it cohesion, that husbands and wives have children, and then a family has a sort of cohesiveness, a mutual loyalty. And that doesn't in any way mean that the individuals involved stop being individuals, because you know, they can fight amongst themselves and bicker and squabble. I mean, God knows my children certainly do, and so do husbands and wives, and they can compete and jockey for position and wrestle with one another. But that only lasts up until the moment that there's some kind of challenge from the outside. As soon as one member of the family is in danger, what happens is that all the members of the family, they set aside, almost always set aside their differences, and then come together as a unit, experiencing what happens to the family as though it's happening to themselves. Now, this is, I argue that this is the most important phenomenon in politics. And if you don't understand this, then you can't understand anything about political life. Families can come together and usually do in what used to be called clans. Now you might call them congregations or communities, but basically an alliance of families to help one another. And clans come together as tribes, and tribes come together as nations. That coming together of tribes as a nation, as you remember, that's one of the central political issues of the Bible, is the question of are the brothers going to unite? Are the Israelite tribes going to come together as a nation and protect one another as they should, according to the biblical author? And the same kind of thing we see in the birth of the English people, the Dutch people, the American people, are all stories of tribes, in the case of the Americans, 13 colonies, very different from one another, highly diverse, competing, feuding, almost at war with one another, who are then able to overcome and to become a nation by developing a mutual loyalty. My argument is that people who criticize nationalism, they almost always have this picture that, well, the nation is homogenous. The nation is nationalism. Its purpose is to squash the identity of all the component groups and make everybody uniform. But in history, you actually see that almost never. I mean, almost the entire history of national independence movements is the opposite. It's a diversity of tribes. Right? A nation is internally diverse with many, many different customs, but they rally around certain things, certain elements that they see as being able to unite them. So it's usually a language, but sometimes it's a religion or a legal system which can unite the tribes, and then the effort is to try to come together in this mutual loyalty. This relationship of mutual loyalty, where I'll fight for you and you'll fight for me, even though there's great diversity internally anyway.
Our guest this morning on the Jefferson Exchange is Yoram Hazony. He is the president of the Herzl Institute in Jerusalem and the author of a new book called The Virtue of Nationalism. I want to take a phone call here very quickly before we head to a break. This is Bill in Eugene. Good morning, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have one or two questions I'll give to you.
Make it one, because we have to go to a break, please.
All right. To try to push morals on the world, where people have basically one morals, I think the UN is completely a joke. When all the countries in the world can vote, and want to pass something, and one of the five Security Council members can just veto it. It means all the countries in the world don't have a say in the future of the UN and what how they, everything goes. Is that correct, my interpretation of the UN? That's my question.
I think your view is basically correct, but I would just ask you whether, do you think that if actually the United Nations will run as a real democracy where, you know, 100 nations could vote against 20 and then decide what's going to happen for the other 20, for the whole world, is that a world that you would want to live in?
A very provocative question. Bill has left us, but go ahead, Dr. Hazzoni.
No, I was just going to say that the British entered the European Union, and they discovered that even though it's a democracy and they had one vote out of 24 or 28, they discovered that it's still a kind of tyranny because they couldn't make decisions for themselves anymore.
We have a lot more to talk about. That kind of leads us to the issue of Brexit and how nations form and how we should go forward as a world. Lots to talk about with Yoram Hazzoni here on the Jefferson Exchange. And we'll be back after a break. Final segment on this morning's Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. You can join our conversation by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. The subject this hour is nationalism, and our guest, Dr. Yoram Hazzoni, who is the director of the Herzl Institute in Jerusalem, is the author of a new book called The Virtues of Nationalism. We often see it in very negative light, but our guest says, wait just a minute. There are lots of important virtues that nationalism has and perhaps can help solve some of the world's problems. In your book, you list the virtues of a nation, virtues that don't, by definition, belong to an empire. Can you briefly take us through those virtues?
I think the most important thing in this list of virtues to understand is that nationalists are described, a person is supporting the idea of national independence, a world made of independent states, is describing a competitive world order. It's like when you describe a market economy that has lots of different private companies, and the advocates of competition in the marketplace, they're always telling us, and I agree with it, that what's important about the market is that lots of different companies means if you have an idea, like you have an innovation, you have an original, something new you'd like to try and sell, then you're free to do that. You can advance this new idea, and if it catches on, well, then everybody benefits because then other people can copy your idea. Whereas if there's one centralized planner for the whole economy, nobody's ever going to innovate because there isn't this kind of competition that allows the freedom of innovation. So the same thing is true in the political order, even though we don't usually talk about it. If you have a world in which there are many different independent nations, that means that each one can develop its own religious traditions, its own constitutional traditions. Now they're competing with one another, right? So I don't want to turn it into like some kind of a utopia. It's not a utopia. The there will be conflicts, and sometimes they'll go to war. But the fundamental idea is that we advance as mankind by allowing different nations, different peoples, to experiment with their own traditions to achieve things that other people haven't before, and in that competition, so if you take a look at early modern Europe, when the idea of the independent national state was really getting started, then you see an unprecedented degree of competition and innovation in government, in economics, in science, in art and theology, and I give some examples in the book. This is the idea of a world in which every nation will be a different experiment in what it means to be human. Some will like more than others, but at least then there's the possibility of innovating and advancing. Whereas when you try to go for this global order, global governance, as they call it today. Basically, what you're saying is that some committee someplace is going to decide what the world's going to be like, and everybody wants to do something different, ends up getting suppressed.
And so if those competing countries do go to war, would that war tend to be lower intensity? I mean, they would go to war over some issue between those two countries, theoretically?
That's part of the argument that I make, is that that if you look at wars between nations, you know, let's take between Britain and Ireland, or between India and Pakistan, or between Israel and its Arab neighbors. These are classic wars between neighboring nations, and I don't want to say that, you know, that it's good to have such wars. It's better to have peace. But usually those wars are they're about border issues. They're about where do you draw a boundary, or natural resources, or the fear that the other side is arming or something. None of these wars, these wars between independent nations, as far as I can tell, these are not the kind of wars that turn into world wars, into vast conflagrations that just destroy large parts of the globe. When we think about the fear of war, you know, most people think about the last century as a century of horrific, catastrophic warfare. But it's not really unprecedented warfare, because before that, before World War I and World War II, there were the Napoleonic Wars, and before that, there was the 30 Years' War in Europe, and you can keep on going back. If you look at these huge systemic wars, what is it that fuels them? It's almost never a war between, or as far as I know, never, just these kind of wars between neighbors about fighting about resources or borders. These are ideological wars. These are wars where somebody wants to take control of the earth, basically, wants to take control of all of Europe, and then from there to try to seize the world. We talked about Hitler earlier, but you can say the same thing about Napoleon. Napoleon's completely explicit that the goal of his wars, which killed nobody knows how many, but you know, at least 3-4 million people died in the Napoleonic Wars. And Napoleon is many people think of him as being a liberal, because you know he read a lot of Rousseau and Voltaire, and he was in favor of equality, but his aim was to take the French way, and to, as he said explicitly, to make sure that France dominates the globe. And when he conquered a country, Napoleon, when he conquers Holland or Spain or Italy or states in Germany, the first thing he does is he eliminates their traditions, and he writes them a new constitution off the top of his head and says, this is the way you're going to live. In other words, what brought about the deaths of these millions upon millions of people is not the fact that there was an independent France that was squabbling about some territory with its neighbors. What brought about the deaths of these millions upon millions of people all the way deep into Russia is this imperialist dream that one people should rule the earth.
So let's return to the next virtue that you mentioned in your book of nations.
Well, I think in a very important one, maybe the one I should have started with, is that that the kinds of freedoms that we, as you know, people who've enjoyed and benefited from the Anglo-American tradition, the kinds of ideas, limited government and individual liberties that characterize the kind of states that we think that we would like to live in, and that we, you know, we'd like to see other people adopt if it's possible. Those kinds of liberties, historically, have only existed in independent national states. There's no multinational empire in history that came close to being run as a democracy. And I don't think this is coincidental. In the book, I argue that that what the way that freedoms develop in places like the Netherlands and England and Scotland and then in the United States, the way that freedoms develop is through the mutual loyalty that we were talking about before. So if you have mutual loyalty among the members of a nation, and then somebody comes and says to the king or the president or the ruler and says, look, I'd like to set up a competing political party. And the king says, well, what's your political competing party? What's it going to do? And you say, well, I'm going to be loyal to the king. I'm not going to try to overthrow the king, but I want to compete against the prime minister and try to propose better policies. And if I win the elections, I'd like for you to take me instead of the prime minister. Now, why should the other party or the king allow something like that? Why should they allow democratic elections? Why should they allow someone to have rights to speak freely or to campaign for office freely? The only way that that can possibly happen is if there's already enough trust and mutual loyalty among all the people in the conversation so that they're not afraid that any right they give you, you'll use in order to destroy them. And that's exactly what we see in a place like England, where over 800 years, the ideas of limited government and rights and liberties that we know were developed. Already in the 1400s, you can read that there was a longstanding tradition that the King of England was not allowed to enter the home of even the lowliest serf because it was his private property. Now, that kind of limitation on the power of the king, why should he accept it? He's only going to accept it if he actually loves his people, if he actually feels loyal to them, if he actually feels like he's not afraid of them, that any right he gives them, they're going to overthrow him. And what that means is that here's what it does not mean. It does not mean that every time you give independence to some nation, they'll develop limited government and individual liberties. That would be a fantasy. But what it does mean is the opposite, that if you want to see limited government and individual liberties and democratic elections where power is shared among competing tribes or competing parties, if you want to see that, that's only going to happen in countries that have a single nation where the people are close enough to trusting one another so it can happen. This is an argument of that was made famous by John Stuart Mill. He said, take a look at all the empires that there are in the world. He was writing in the 1860s, like Austria-Hungary, all these multinational empires. Not a single one of them is anything other than a tyranny, because the peoples, the different nations inside the empire, have no trust for one another. They have no mutual loyalty. And so it's not possible for them to develop freedom.
Our guest this morning is Yoram Hazony. He is the author of a book called The Virtue of Nationalism. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have a fair number of calls waiting. The one I was just going to take just left us. So we'll continue with some additional questions here. So when we look at existing nations in the world right now, for example, Israel has accepted Jews from all over the world, but the state of Israel, the citizens of Israel, are joined by a shared religious and moral tradition. And I look at other countries in the world that are more homogeneous, like Iceland and Finland, very successful nations. They have a very homogeneous population. But in the United States and many other countries, we have a much more diverse population. And this kind of gets into the current debate about immigration. In the United States, there are those who see immigration as kind of threatening the United States' national identity. So how do you create a successful nation state when you have such a diverse population?
Well, look, it really is a super question. I think the picture is a little bit more complicated. It's true that to to an outsider, Israel looks like it's a homogenous country because the great majority of the population are Jews. But I think that, you know, anyone who's living inside one of these countries, and I have a suspicion it would be true for most of them, not just Israel. If you said to them, you know, your population is homogenous, they'd kind of shake their heads and laugh because the internal tensions among the different Jewish groups in Israel are very great, and that's before you add minority populations. There are Muslim Arabs and Christian Arabs and many other smaller nationalities, Druze and Circassians and Armenians, many other nationalities that make up the tapestry of a country like Israel that looks homogenous from the outside, but in reality is not. And I would say that the United States tends to exaggerate the degree to which it is diverse. I mean, America has, let's say, at least until the last few decades, the United States was overwhelmingly a country that understood itself to be Christian, that had the English language.
Dr. Hazzoni, I'm very sorry to interrupt you because we are out of time. We could go on most of the morning talking about this fascinating book, The Virtue of Nationalism, Dr. Yoam Hazzoni from Jerusalem. Thank you very much for joining us this morning on the Jefferson Exchange. We appreciate your time.
Sure, thank you.